We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover, starting with local and Mayor McGinn and the SPD.
Yes, Mayor McGinn sent a letter this week to the Department of Justice regarding its letter that it had sent to the Seattle Police Department on November 23rd. Now, the Department of Justice letter to the Seattle Police Department in November had to do with the SPD's use of Garrity protections. Garrity protections specify that officers can provide, quote, true and involuntary statements, end quote, that can't be used against them in criminal cases. Now, the Department of Justice
They can be used for internal
investigations,
but they can't be used for criminal cases.
For criminal cases, yeah. And the Department of Justice letter said that the SPD had institutionalized their Garrity protections. In other words, they required SPD officers to invoke Garrity in almost all instances whenever force is used, meaning that SPD officers had literally become protected by the police department from any kind of criminal prosecutions in almost every case in which force is used. And the Department of Justice said, well, that's an abuse of Garrity.
And it's very likely that was part of the decision to not prosecute in the John T. Williams case, for example.
And the case of Officer Lee, who was caught on a video camera kicking a young teenage suspect in a convenience store. And that suspect, of course, I want to point out, was arrested, but he was later released and not charged. Now, the letter that Mayor McGinn sent this week was in response to the Department of Justice letter about the Garrity protections. And in that letter, Mayor McGinn points out that he has discussed this issue with Police Chief John Diaz, and that the SPD is setting up two new boards to review use of force. But, of course, both of these boards are in-house. One is the Force Review Board, which will also have a force investigation team with it, and the other is the professional standards section. Now, the professional standards section, the letter says that it's got some duties. It will do research on standards and best practices. It will do internal audits and inspections. And, of course, it will also manage the Department of Justice investigation. Now, that's kind of a vague description, and it doesn't tell us how this is going to help things. The Force Review Board and the Force Investigative Team, he doesn't specify in his letter what these will be doing, if anything.
Yeah, there's two notable things about the letter in that regard. One is that there's no details. Another is that it wasn't mentioned in the letter, but McGinn said this separately in response to a question that how those bodies are set up will almost certainly have to be negotiated with the Police Officers Guild, meaning that they are very unlikely to have any teeth.
Yeah, and they're also going to be in-house, so no civilians probably, or if there are civilians, it will be people who have probably worked for the SPD or another enforcement agency in the past. This, I want to point out, too, is a far cry from a civilian review board, which is something that activists in the city have been calling for over a decade.
And it is not likely to mollify the Department of Justice.
All right. City Council and rental housing.
Yeah, there's a law. There's a draft law up before the City Council on rental housing inspections. Currently in the city of Seattle, rental housing inspections are only done after tenants complain. And tenants complain at the risk of retaliation from their landlord. Now, the draft law, which was sponsored by Nick Licata, included initially input taken from landlords, but also from public health advocates and also from tenant representatives, including the tenants' union. Originally, the bill included a third-party inspection program of rental units, one in which a third-party government inspector of some kind would come in and look at each rental unit on a scheduled basis. But now suddenly that has been watered down so that landlords would be able to self-certify that they're in compliance with city codes just by signing a document. and that inspectors contacted by the Department of Planning and Development wouldn't have to actually do a full inspection. They would only do a drive-by inspection of the outside of the building, which sort of begs the question of, if you're not going to do interior inspections, how are you going to tell if the building doesn't have heat or doesn't have hot water, if it's got water or roof leaks, if it's crowded, if you've got, you know, more than the law specifies in the number of inhabitants in that space, if there's a lack of adequate kitchen or bathroom facilities, if it lacks ventilation, lacks light, has dangerous wiring, has bug or rat infestations, if the smoke detectors work, even if there are smoke detectors, if it has faulty plumbing, if the toilet backs up, et cetera, all things that are not, I don't want to say common, but things that even I've seen in rental housing in the city of Seattle, where we have to rely on a tenant reporting system in order to get rental housing units inspected. And this bill, if it does pass the city council, I don't think it's any improvement on the system that we've had in the past. It could, in fact, be worse.
All right. Moving to the state, and the state Republicans have a plan.
Yeah, the state Republicans this week came up with their plan for increasing revenue to try to fill the $2 billion budget hole. They said, we've got a great idea. This will help. Let's propose that slot machines be allowed in private card rooms. Currently, slot machines are only allowed on Native American casinos in the state, not allowed in the few private card rooms that are allowed to operate in the state of Washington. And the Republicans said, well, we could get, you know, maybe $100 million from allowing a certain number of slot machines. But of course, the budget hole is $2 billion, and $100 million is about a 20th of the amount of money needed to plug the budget hole. And of course, as we know, slot machines are the most addictive form of gambling, also the most accessible, and particularly with penny slots, it's also the one that is geared specifically for the poorest person to walk in the door.
Yeah, and as people may remember, Tim Iman sponsored an initiative a few years ago to make those slot machines much more widely available, and that was resoundingly defeated.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, one of the recent initiatives, 1183, is being challenged.
Yeah, 1183, the Costco's liquor privatization initiative, had two lawsuits filed against it in court in Washington State this week. Both one of them coming from the union members who work in the state liquor stores, another from wine distributors, and both of them on the same grounds. Speaking of Tim Iman, folks may remember his I-695 was thrown out a number of years ago on the grounds that it covered two subjects. Well, 1183 actually also covers two subjects, because Costco, in addition to the $80 million a year that they're going to make on hard liquor privatization, also slipped a provision into 1183 that rewrote the rules on wine distributors to allow wholesale distributors like Costco to negotiate volume price breaks on wine. So folks are now filing suit saying that wine, hard liquor, those are two. One is a rewrite of distribution law, the other are regulations, the other is a privatization of hard liquor distribution, that they're two very separate subjects. And so
that violates the state rule, the state law, that initiatives can only be about one thing.
Yeah, that's written into the Constitution. And so there's going to be a preliminary hearing coming up in a couple weeks here to issue an injunction against 1183 until this can be settled in court.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with Plan B.
Yeah, this week Plan B was stopped. And for folks who don't know what Plan B was, Plan B is a form of birth control. Well, it's an after-the-fact form of birth control. It is not RU486, as many people, particularly conservatives, think it is. It's a progesterone pill that a woman can take after she has had unprotected sex that works, and the way that they believe it works is that it stops ovulation, and it may also have an effect on a woman's uterus, making her less likely to implant an egg and become pregnant. It can cut the risk of pregnancy in half if it's taken very soon after unprotected sex. Now, Plan B, initially, the Bush administration resisted making Plan B available over the counter, but it eventually gave in and made it available to women over 18, and then a court ruling ruled that women 17 should be allowed to also get Plan B over the counter, so it is currently available to women 17 and older. Now, Teva Pharmaceuticals, the company that makes Plan B, they did a study, two studies, in fact, that looked at Plan B and whether it had any kind of adverse effects in adolescents, so in girls from 12 to 16, with the notion that it should be available for them as well, considering that a lot of women who have unwanted pregnancies are unwed teenage mothers. They wanted something available for teenagers to take after the fact. Now, Teva Pharmaceuticals' two studies showed that there was no difference in terms of side effects in adolescent girls from adult women. And so they applied to the FDA to allow it to be sold over the counter to girls, to remove the age restriction for it to be sold over the counter. And the FDA was all set and ready to approve it when Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius decided to trump science and to stop Plan B.
This was against the rulings also of FDA's own scientists and their
recommendations. Yes, yes. So she is definitely trumping scientists. She's saying those studies don't matter because here's her reasoning. 11-year-old girls might take it, and 11-year-old girls were not part of the study. Okay, well, look. If they had included 11-year-old girls, she would have said, well, 10-year-old girls might take it, and 10-year-old girls are not part of the study. Or she might say, okay, 3-year-old girls might take it, and 3-year-old girls weren't. I mean, excuse me. If you've reached puberty, you've reached puberty regardless of your numerical age. She did not cite any reasonable evidence to support her theory that 11-year-old girls might have a different reaction to the drug from a 12-year-old girl, for example, who was the age group that was included in the study. And I just want to point out to Kathleen Sebelius and any of our listeners that half of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned pregnancies. 40% or more of the babies born each year are to unwed mothers. And there are 1.2 million abortions every year in the United States. Plan B is necessary, particularly for teenage girls, it's a safe way to prevent the terror and the risks of an early pregnancy for young girls who can't support a child. And the fact that we can't allow it to be sold over the counter to teenagers, I think, is shocking.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of speculation this week about, because the reason that Sebelius gave is so transparently idiotic, that there's been a lot of speculation as to what the actual reason might be. And it's centered around a couple things. One of them is that this was a higher-up decision in the Obama administration that was made for political reasons to forestall any kind of possible criticism in an election year that the Obama administration is trying to encourage teen sex. Well, I'm sorry, teen sex happens. It is a fact of life, and the question is, for pro-life activists, whether you want abortions as a result of those of that sexual activity, or whether you want some safe way to handle it, or whether you want unwed teen mothers. So that's one area of speculation.
And I also want to point out, too, that Plan B is much safer, particularly for teenagers, than taking RU486. Would you rather have your daughter come to you and say, I think, I had unprotected sex, I think I need something, and you have to take her to a doctor and have her do RU486 versus taking Plan B. As a mother, I would be buying Plan B for my daughter, and I'd be wondering, why the heck can't she do that herself instead of having to come to me?
Yeah, and the other area of speculation is the whole issue of encouraging teen sex that criticism comes from. The idea that because you're making birth control, even after the fact birth control, available to teenage girls, that you're somehow encouraging them to be more reckless in their sexual habits, when again, the reason these pregnancies happen is because they are unplanned. Mm-hmm. They are spontaneous. Stuff happens. happens when you're a teenager and your body is raging full of hormones and it's telling you to do something. And I'm sorry, but all the abstinence curriculum in the world is not going to prevent that. In fact, it probably helps encourage it. So, you know, it really is an indictment of a serious misconception that our country has around teen sex and the healthiness of it and the reality of it, as opposed to the sort of Victorian mores that some cultural conservatives would like to promote.
That we see even from our president, who supported Sebelius's move.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, developments this week regarding Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania deciding this week not to retry the death penalty sentencing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose death sentence had been overturned by a court, I believe, last year, that ordered him retried on the sentencing phase of his trial. This after 30 plus years ends the legal questions around Mumia Abu-Jamal. He will spend the rest of his days in serving life without parole. His options in terms of trying to appeal the sentence on the basis of trying to get a new trial have been exhausted, unless at some point he actually just gets his sentence commuted, which politically speaking is not very likely. But it does get him off of death row after 30 years, and it means he will have a lot more rights and relative to death row inmates, a lot more freedom for the rest of his days. So it of course removes the threat of execution. So it is very, very good news.
All right. Department of Justice settlements.
Let's start with the Labor Department report that came out this week, 972-page report on Massey Mines. Folks may remember the mine disaster in West Virginia in April of 2010 that killed 29 miners. That Labor Department report basically laying the entire blame for the disaster on the safety practices of Massey Mines, including the fact that they kept two separate sets of safety books, one internally for their own use and then another to show federal inspectors didn't mention any of the problems that they were aware of. That and a number of other things suggest that they were criminally negligent in a lot of their practices and also tried very hard to obstruct the investigation into the Massey Mine disaster. That same day that report came out, the Department of Justice announced that there would not be any criminal prosecution of Massey Mine, that in fact that they were settling with Massey Mine for a $209 million settlement with no admission of wrongdoing by Massey Mines. That $209 million includes only $35 million that's actually related to damages for the mine disaster itself, of which only $10 million was the actual related to the April 2010 disaster. The other $175 million is safety improvements that Massey agreed to undertake in its mines, most of which will be tax deductible. So no admission of criminal wrongdoing, no culpability for its corporate executives, and tax deductibility for most of the fines, very few of which will actually go to the families of the dead miners. And in fact, damages for those dead miners' families in civil suits are actually capped as a result of this settlement as well.
All right. Anything else coming out of the DOJ?
Nope. Yeah, there were two settlements this week with Wachovia, which is an arm of Wells Fargo now, over rigging bids in municipal bond markets. One of the settlements came from the DOJ and one from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, of the two settlements, the Department of Justice was the tougher one because the Department of Justice required Wachovia, quote, admits, acknowledges, and accepts responsibility for its actions. The Security and Exchange Commission, however, it only required Wachovia. It said Wachovia settled, quote, without admitting or denying the allegations, end quote. This is a controversial clause. This doesn't admit or deny responsibility. Jav, I think, talked about this last week, how a New York Federal Court Judge Jed Rakoff rejected the SEC settlement with Citigroup, saying, quote, it is neither fair nor reasonable nor adequate nor in the public interest, the neither admit or deny clause within the settlement.
Yeah, and he wasn't talking about just Citigroup. He was talking about all these types of settlements, which the SEC has a long history of.
This is the SEC's modus operandi for all of these lawsuits. And I just want to point out that the SEC has plenty of evidence with which to pursue Wachovia, that in fact the settlement documents contain plenty of facts that they could use to pursue a case in court. And there's probably a lot of additional information. They probably only cited the most egregious examples. But, of course, the SEC is still too sensitive to the complaints of financial companies. Even, it's clear now, the ones that that appears to be they have plenty of evidence that the company committed fraud. They're instead of taking them to court, trying to get a much larger judgment, as Judge Rakoff had pointed out, that they probably could do, but he couldn't tell because the neither admit nor deny clause didn't give him enough information in which to judge the settlement. Instead of doing that, they're opting for these lower monetary value settlements in order to get them cleared off their case list faster.
Yeah, to put this into context, less than 10 days after Judge Rakoff said that the SEC's practices of doing these kind of settlements with large financial institutions was not only contrary to law, but also antithetical to the public interest, the SEC turns around and does exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's what they're doing time and time again, and they're not changing their tactics, even though one judge rejected one settlement suit. And now the Wachovia suit is not going to be heard by Judge Rakoff. He's in New York. It's going to be heard in a New Jersey court. So we'll see if a second judge comes up and says the same thing.
All right. Moving on, congressional developments this week related to Eric Cantor.
Yeah, Majority Leader Eric Cantor in the House of Representatives killed a bill this week that would have made illegal inside trading by congresspeople. Now, inside stock trading is an illegal activity unless you're a member of Congress, in which case it is, in fact, perfectly legal. Why would Eric Cantor have done this? Well, it turns out that he bought up to $15,000 in shares of ProShares Trust Ultra Short 20-Year Plus Treasury 20 plus a year Treasury ETF in December of 2008. That you may remember is right in the middle of the financial meltdown that came at the end of the Bush administration. He was shorting government bonds, in other words, immediately after he had a secret briefing from the Bush administration suggesting that the financial markets were about to collapse.
That kind of sounds like insider trading to me.
As a matter of fact, it actually is. The reason that a bill was being proposed by another Republican, Spencer Baucus of Alabama, was that he did even worse. And it had been publicized in a 60 Minutes report that Baucus had come out of a hearing in the same time frame with then Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson, suggesting that the financial markets are about to collapse, and turned around and again shorted government bonds and did so, making tens of thousands of dollars on that one particular day, but also pulling the same trick again literally dozens of times over the course of several months. So he got a lot of public heat for that, and he was turning around and trying to make it illegal so that he could look better. And Eric Cantor basically called him into his office and says, "You are absolutely not doing this. It could cost me money."
All right. And finally, Republican filibuster.
Yeah, the Gang of 14 is dead. That was the group of seven Democratic and seven Republican congresspeople that had agreed, senators that had agreed not to filibuster judicial nominations. The Republicans, however, this week filibustered a completely uncontroversial nominee to the district's D.C. District Circuit Court, a woman named Caitlin Halligan, who is very moderate, but she's an Obama appointee, and it's in an election year, and therefore the Republicans filibustered it. So you can look forward to a lot more judicial filibusters in the near future coming to a Congress, dysfunctional Congress near you.
All right. Egypt.
Yeah, Egypt. Jav, I think you talked about the elections last week.
Yes.
Well, the results of the elections are still coming in. It takes a while to count all of the votes in all of the provinces in Egypt, particularly the rural areas. But what they're finding is about 40% of the electorate voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist group, not the most extreme Islamist group in the country, though. That would be the Salafis, and they've taken about 25%. So the two of them together have a clear majority. This week, the Egyptian military said, well, we're not going to let the parliament convene a committee to rewrite the constitution. We're going to appoint the committee to rewrite the constitution. And that surprised everybody because it was the military that had agreed that the parliamentary elections would then set up a parliament that would convene a constitutional council. So the military is clearly saying, well, because we don't like the results of the election, we're keeping control. And I think that's been the risk all along, and I'm not surprised by that. Although people in Egypt are not happy. We'll see if protests continue there.
And mind you, there's a precedent for this type of thing because it was exactly the reaction of the Bush administration to the elections in Palestine. They didn't like the results, and therefore their elections were invalid. And they're just taking their lead from the United States on that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And finally, briefly, Global Witness.
Yeah, Global Witness was one of the watchdog groups that helped set up the Kimberley process. The Kimberley process was set up about a decade ago in order to certify diamonds that had come from non-conflict areas in Africa. Now, a lot of folks who follow the conflicts going on in Africa know that a lot of them are fights over resources, particularly diamond mines. And the whole idea behind the Kimberley process was to set up a certification program to show that to allow consumers, people who buy diamond jewelry, that they could buy diamonds that were certified not to have come from areas where there was fighting over diamond mines, particularly fighting that is bloody, that kills civilians, that you know what I'm talking about, places like Angola and Sierra Leone and Liberia. The Global Witness Group has decided that because the Kimberley process has broken down and that it is almost impossible now to tell whether diamonds come from areas where there's been conflict, they've decided to withdraw from the Kimberley process. And essentially, they're thrown in the towel, one of the main groups to set up the process in the first place. So that's not very good news in terms of consumers who buy diamonds. And, of course, I've always thought that that was not a great thing to do myself, and I would urge people, if you want to buy a wedding ring, try buying something else besides a diamond.
You don't know where it comes from, and you probably don't want to know.
Yeah.
All right. Events.
A number of events coming up this week, starting actually a half hour ago. The second day of the Seattle Race Initiative is going on. It's going on until 4:30, so still a lot of good stuff you can check out. That'll be at Mount Zion Baptist Church, 1634 19th Avenue on Capitol Hill. Also today, from noon to 4, Occupy This Moment, a forum on the Occupy movement. That's happening at University Christian Church in the U District at 50th and 15th Northeast. Monday, the Occupy movement is doing a West Coast port shutdown of all the ports on the West Coast, also Houston, and for that matter, Walmart distribution centers in Denver and Salt Lake City, because they don't have ports. The port shutdown in Seattle is going to be taking place all Monday afternoon, starting with a rally at Westlake at 1 o'clock at 4th and Pine, and then they'll be marching down to the port of Seattle. There'll be two rallies near the port, one at 3 p.m. and another one at 6 p.m. that'll be at the Spokane Street fishing area, and that's just to the east of the Spokane Street Bridge near the intersection of Southwest Spokane and Southwest Manning Street under the West Seattle Bridge. The rallies are family friendly and the blockades are separate. There will be an opportunity for people who want to participate in the blockades, but you never tell with the police, but chances are it'll be pretty safe to actually go to the rallies. So the other thing going on Monday, from 6 to 8 o'clock, Nova's Guatemala Committee is doing a fundraiser at 10,000 Villages, 6417 Roosevelt Way Northeast in the Roosevelt neighborhood. So go help support that very fine and worthy cause.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And we are now compiling suggestions for our annual overhyped and underreported stories. So email them to us at editorial@eatthestate.org.